It's Icon Art Radio with Alan Cobb, Donna Colby, and me, Bill Teeple. Last show, we wandered all over the place trying to locate what it is to be an artist, why an artist does it in the first place, what is this impulse that drives it. And we can't seem to let go of the subject because it seems to be what it's all about. It got real slippery because it seems to be what the artist is attempting to do is to give, that he's more not trying to do anything or giving anything, he's riding the urge of the universe to move forward and express itself. And he's more on the subject than, say, all the rest of us who are just going to work and putting nuts and bolts on screws and things like that. And yet it's all driven by the same force.
And even the person who has the job where they're putting nuts and bolts in, you know, and have some kind of a routine job, you can generally find something in anybody's life that gets to that point. You know, maybe that person goes home and does gardening on the weekend or whatever. You know, there, it's like that force that we tapped into at the end of last show is too huge. It's too strong and universal a force to ever be totally squelched in anybody, I think.
Well, it's the essence of the process of living, even you know, at the dullest level. You really can't say that an earthworm is uncreative. Mm-hmm. It's doing its thing. It's producing more earthworms. It's aerating the soil. It's, you know, feeding the fish or whatever other things it contributes. And it's sentient in its own small, you know, slimy way.
Well, it's probably feeling yum yum as it chews.
There's probably a lot of enjoyment involved.
Well, that's why those films about insects and all, you know, where they show like close-ups of all kinds of insects doing their little insect activities are such works of art because, you know, they're not having, the insects, as far as we know, are not having the emotional experience of creating art the same way a painter in a studio would. Yet, how do we know, you know,
what that wonderful
insect
idea.
Is actually
I love to think that it is.
But in any case, living, it's a living art form, just like a flower
absolutely.
You know, obviously a flower is an exquisite living act of creation. And
but I had a friend who used to collect longhorn beetles. Mm-hmm. And when I first heard that he was a beetle collector, I thought, well, okay, you know, there are some cool beetles, but you've seen one, you've seen them all. Well, you know, once you look at beetles through the eyes of an entomologist specializing in Cerambycidae, who's, you know, like discovered 12 species all by himself and isn't even a professional, you begin to realize that, you know, nature is going berserk designing beetle variations. There's like tens of thousands of longhorn beetle species. They're all over the place, and they're all different. And you know, it's selecting your favorite beetle species. I mean, not the favorite individual beetle, but your favorite species from the tens of thousands available is itself an artistic process. Mm. And yet, what are you doing? You're appreciating the artistic results of the forces of nature
or of
God, who is just having a blast doing beetle stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, you sort of get the impression that maybe there's an archangel on some level who is responsible for the beetle collection of the planet Earth. Mm-hmm. And he's this guy who just loves little mechanical gizmos, you know, and he builds these crazy beetles. And you know, and you look at one of them and you think it's bizarre. And then the entomologist says, oh, yeah, but, you know, you should see this one. And by the way, these are just longhorn, you know, which is a category of species. You know, we haven't even talked about the scarabs yet.
Well, which is why Annie Dillard got her Pulitzer Prize when she wrote Pilgrim at Tinker Creek, because she, even as a little girl, was mm-hmm. that kind of kid who just would see one, and she would ask like all the questions, well, what else is there, and how many kinds of rocks are there, and where yeah. are they found, and things like that. And so her whole book of Pilgrim at Tinker Creek, she went to, I think it was in North Carolina or someplace like that, and she would go and sit at the same spot on the creek every day and write about what she experienced. And over this long period of time, she saw like worlds and dramas and mm-hmm. colors and, you know, transformations, and just like what you were saying, and it made it thrilling.
Yeah.
In this.
But we're watching it from the outside. There was a subject. Steve yeah. being inside each beetle, yeah. which yeah. is ourselves,
mm-hmm. yeah.
as beetle level of evolution. Mm-hmm. And that beetle is motivated by all these most basic urges, probably to eat and procreate.
So how much do you think then of what an artist, what, let's say a painter, in his or her studio, how much of what that painter is doing has to do with that same primal urge that the insect world and all these other, and the flowers and everything have, and how much is it an individuated or specifically human kind of process?
Well, I think compared to the beetles, that the human is much more on the verge of self-realization, so that we're suddenly becoming conscious of ourselves as manifest. Investing the universe.
Yeah.
While the beetle is just responding to stimuli
yeah.
in a very much more human way than we would probably think.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, all humans are conscious of what they're doing to some degree. And I think what I was saying in my, you know, vague definition of an artist was that the only difference between an artist and all the other human beings is one of degree. In that the artist is a little more self-aware of the process and of himself as a part of that process, and is doing the process deliberately because of something that comes from the process. Everyone gets what it is that comes from the process, whether they're thinking about it or not, but the artist has kind of adopted an attitude that he's going to do it deliberately. He wants more of that specifically.
Yeah, so yeah. That's the yeah. subject of his activity, rather yeah. than making money or putting a roof over his right. children's yeah. head.
So when they're doing that, then how much control is involved from the individual artist, and how much of it is just peeling away the obstacles to tapping into that creative force?
Well, it's exactly that. It's total control and total absence. And the only way you can achieve the control you need is by not being there, and or by just being there. And that's, you know, that's the paradox of trying to define it, because an artist is constantly making decisions and coercing things and selecting and rejecting and preferring and so forth. But in order to do that with innocence, he has to also, you know, almost not be there at all. Because the life force, the you know, the tendency of nature in living things to extract orderliness from the environment is inevitable and unending. So, you know, you can't have humans without having artists. But you certainly can have people being, you know, putting higher priority on things that we recognize as having to do with art, and other people putting less priority on that. But they're still all really doing the same thing, I think.
So this thing that, you know, this constant kind of juggling and balancing of the decision-making and controlling and all that, and the pulling all of the barriers aside and being innocent, tapping into the creative force, that's probably part of the essence of the struggle we talked about in the last show, is when you sense inside that maybe you've gone a little bit too far on the control side of things and you've lost your innocence, or maybe you've completely thrown away the intention and the control, and you're trying to just be like completely let it all hang out, and it's just, there's too, it's too boundless. So do you think that's part of the struggle that artists feel?
I would say as long as the struggle is there, that that you haven't reached the point of what art is, that it really isn't a struggle the way I see it. And the struggle is the intrusion of history and personality and, you know, priorities and attachment to the result and, you know, emotional issues and stuff like that. But the actual process, I don't see any struggle. It's sort of like, you know, again, I mean, Agnes, you know, could have said, when I don't know what to paint, it's you know, it's a real problem until I can think of the next thing to paint. But instead, what she does is she waits. Mm-hmm. She does nothing until it comes, and then she's, oh, that's what I'll paint.
And, yeah. No,
you know, is that a struggle, or I don't think so.
Well, I think it's this thing of life itself, and life is an effortless process, mm-hmm. and yet we all seem to make a mess and a struggle of it.
Yeah.
I think it's that we get in the way.
Yeah, we identify with the process.
Like, what he's saying is we have to learn as mature artists mm-hmm. to get out of the way and just be, let what is already happening happen through us.
Yeah.
And we become a pure... I mean, there's very few people that can do this. That's mm-hmm. why the world is such a mess in every way, because there's seldom an individual who is that pure and innocent. I mean, Agnes mm-hmm. Martin stands out.
Oh, she's mm-hmm. astonishing.
Crowd.
Yeah.
I probably refer to her too much, but she's really...
Well, this was
if you
great,
haven't when, seen her yeah. in that film about her, then...
I think that's... So what we're talking about is this... this life itself, this experience. I mean, I just she is such a great example, because she basically said, forget all that junk. Mm-hmm. Look at what I have done. I love what I did. I love these lines. And yeah. they're completely valid on their own terms, because I say so. Because if they weren't valid in their own terms, I would have burnt them.
Yeah.
So it's, you know, it's a totally pure expression of life's love of life.
Yeah.
Through her.
Yeah, and the last film, when we saw the film on about I.M. Pei, the architect, and the museum that he created in Japan, I got that same feeling about him and his work, different, completely different kind of art form, and his, because he had to integrate the form of the building with the form of the mountains and with the desires of the people in the villages around there. It was, you know, a more like complex kind of creative process. But I got the same, every time you'd see his face when he was talking about it, he had that same quality that Agnes Martin had of just almost childlike joy in the process of even facing the big problems of yeah.
Well,
yeah.
Nothing could be more complex. And he talked about this. In fact, have already played, now that I think about it. the second part of that, he talks more about his philosophy and all. Mm-hmm. But this guy is up. He's a happy man.
Yeah.
And yet... you can see that there is struggle, and you can mostly see the struggle in all the people around him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Trying to figure out, how are we going to do this? Because what I was saying is that he talks about architecture being such an integration of idea and pure and physical manifestation.
Yeah.
And this project on the mountain was such a great example, because they ran into one thing after another, trying to create this really complex physical manifestation where it wouldn't disturb nature at all. But I mean, complex concrete and metal structures, and you can see that he was seeing this perfect world, in front of him. And then there was all the ways that how can we do this? And you could see that he was, I mean, he probably would get daunted at times, but in the video, it seemed like he was just on problem solving and problem solving and problem solving, that he was just one pointed towards getting to the goal. He had to figure it out, and he figured it all out. Mm-hmm. But you could see the consternation on the faces around him of those who he would say, well, we missed this, and can't we this? And they were going, oh, no.
Yeah, because he came in with one sentence and say, now, we need to move this huge tree 5 feet to the left, things like that. But
why? Because he felt yes. See, that we keep coming back to this thing of yes, yes, yes. And that's what drives artists. I mean, when I'm working on a piece, if it's wrong feeling, it's wrong. And it won't feel right until it feels right. Mm. And what that is, I don't know. I mean, it's just what... Everybody's got a different yes, because it being all illusion.
Well, and we choose different directions. And of course, it's perfectly possible to choose a direction that will never, ever be realized. In which case, if you're attached to getting to the goal, you'll be guaranteed to be disappointed at some stage when you discover it's impossible.
So what do you think, since there are so many stories of artists, like Jackson Pollock is one example, and Van Gogh is another example, people who really did suffer, even though they were living a life of...
It's just a misunderstanding. Creating. I mean, why did Pollock suffer? Well, one reason he suffered is that he was an incorrigible alcoholic. Mm-hmm. If that doesn't cause suffering, I don't know what does. And it's got nothing to do with being a painter. But he also suffered towards the end of his life because he was beginning to reach a transition, and he didn't know what he was going to do next. And that frightened him. Mm-hmm. Some people would find that exciting or exhilarating or challenging or inspiring. He, as an alcoholic with obviously a pretty low self-image, you know, concluded that he had nothing more to say, and or whatever it was he had to say would never be able to say. And, you know, it bummed him out. Mm. But I don't see that really having much of anything to do with him being an artist. It might have something to do with his choice of content when he paints.
So the suffering artist myth or, you know, archetype and all that.
I think it's...
is not a function of being an artist. Mm. It's just certain individuals
have
a
function of art.
I think it's a romantic, historical
thing
we're still writing in this age, because I think for every suffering artist, there's one who was
having a blast.
Blissful,
ecstatic.
You know? I mean, I think...
Well, I guess it's the same thing with any field. Like spirituality has the same kind of
archetype. We must suffer to realize ourselves.
Right.
Yeah, there are
I'm
some
going to
convents
self-mutilate myself today.
Yeah. Well, there are some convents and monasteries where austerity and deprivation and suffering are the path, and there are others in the same, you know, in the same religion where it's a joyful process and they're very happy to be doing what they're doing.
Just like there are some art schools that are torture and other art schools where it's wonderful.
No, I think we're carrying a strong load from the past of this idea of that you must suffer.
Sure.
It's a struggle like that. And that art school is full of demeaning, ridiculing professors that make you feel terrible about yourself. And it's only necessary if you're going to make it in this dog-eat-dog art world, you know.
And it was thought, I think, like in the Romantic Age in the early 1800s, when that shift took place, it was considered almost cold to be, like, happy and lighthearted. You know, you just... Art at that during that period of time was considered meaningful and really genuine art if you addressed the horrible conflicts within the turbulent human emotions, you know, and people, the poets who talked about heartbreak and insatiable longings were considered that art was considered more valid than somebody, than like Wordsworth, who talked about the beauty of the daffodils in the field.
Well, even today in New York, to go and to mm-hmm. present something that's pretty, or to talk about beauty, you know, it's out of fashion. It's been out of fashion for some time. You have to be kind of cool and jaded, and that's the right attitude.
Yeah, what you put your attention on grows stronger. So if the anguish of unrequited love is your topic, then, you know, after you've written a couple dozen poems on that and maybe a novel and, you know, a few tragic paintings and things, you might find that you do a better job of it if you bum yourself out on the same topic. But, you know, that's still a choice. It's still an artistic preference.
And it's something that, like, I'm always fascinated if you see, like, a big, like, the Picasso Museum in Barcelona, where they have a real ride, you know, his first painting he did when he was 8 years old, and then this huge range of all through his career. And when I went, they were having, it was about war and peace. And so they had the whole collection of all the paintings he did on both of those sides of the coin. And it was very dramatic how he, what it said in the little pieces, you know, hanging there in the museum, the little stories behind it, is that a lot of people, when he started doing the peace paintings, were highly critical because they thought it was like silly for him to paint like people dancing around in a circle with flowers around their heads, you know, and stuff like that. That here's Picasso who painted Guernica, you know, and he's painting these silly paintings.
Yeah.
But they are, you know, they're beautiful paintings representing peace. And why did people feel it to be so necessary to criticize him?
Well, this is interesting because Picasso was still Picasso. And this was Picasso, who we would consider a fairly mature and accomplished creator, choosing to paint people dancing around with little, you know, doves and things. He was no less of Picasso then. He was Picassoing then as he was before. The viewers had become attached to something that they associated with Picasso, and that they needed to feel. And so when these artists sometimes make these moves, I mean, the Beatles, so many great artists and great cultural movers.
Dylan went electric.
What's that?
Bob Dylan went electric.
I mean, that like blew the lid off of people very attached to folk music.
Yeah.
Now, where is beauty in all of this, and where is truth and art? Well, it seems to be more that people's identities were challenged, and that sometimes art has to do. Sometimes people get into art appreciation and creating art more to establish an identity for themselves, as opposed to being on this pursuit of truth.
Right.
And when that identity gets rattled, they fall apart, or the audience falls apart, or everything goes funny.
Or their attention just goes off of the art onto the effect of the art. You know, Dylan or Picasso is considered by his fans at a particular stage in either of their careers to be a powerful spokesman for things that they identify with
that they believe in. Right.
And then he starts talking about something else, and they're saying, no, wait a minute, we haven't said enough about this yet.
So here's the point again. When this person is standing in front of this painting or listening to this bit of music, and they're saying yes, are they saying, yes, me? Yes, me.
Mm. Oh, and yeah.
They're saying,
I get it.
Resonance. I'm resonating.
Because
with
I know personally from my own experience in manifesting things that I will make things for one reason and people will get them for another reason. Yeah. It has to do, and it's illusory. That person will be somehow seen in this thing that I've hung on the wall in a very purist mirror-like situation. And they're allowed, because of the latitude within the art world, to take what they want from it. And many times they're fulfilling themselves because you've given them an opportunity to do it. And I did it myself with songs that I thought one I thought the words were one thing,
yeah.
only 10 years later to find out there's something else. And my right. yes had to do with hearing the words the way I heard them.
Well, they're
icons. In other words, my yeah. own art that was inside myself was being created
sure.
by yeah. myself as I looked at somebody else's art. Later, I learned how to make my own art.
Well, what
so we create, we create a work of art by as a process of our own growth, but somebody else looking at that turns it into an icon, enters that doorway, and then just like in religious culture, you know, specific religions, they each have their formal icons mm-hmm. that when everybody in that religion looks at that particular same image, it takes them through a certain doorway. Mm-hmm. And yet that's how religions become stagnant, when there isn't growth to newer icons or, I mean, in the art world, I mean, this is what I was thinking when you were talking about Picasso and Bob Dylan and all that. The audience is more interested in what the icon is doing for them than tapping into the growth that the artist is, which can be just as big or even bigger, an even bigger icon to mm-hmm. say, why did Picasso do that? Why did he shift? What is he?
Well, I think we've created the topic for the next show, because what we've come onto now is the difference between an artist who decides to express herself in a particular way, and then an audience comes along and turns what was, in a sense, an expression, and turns that into a communication. An expression mm-hmm. is a in a sense mm-hmm. is like a line with one point, and the other end of the line doesn't exist. Whereas a communication is a line with a point at each end, and then you have to look at both points to understand it. So, you know, Guernica is clearly a statement, but it's also a communication, and people see it and get something from it. Mm-hmm. But whatever it was that Picasso got from it didn't require anyone to ever see it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm sure, again, like me, he enjoyed having people appreciate his work. I mean, I think from what we know of Picasso, he enjoyed it a very great deal. But that distinction between an expression and a communication is a very substantial one.
So tune in next time for the discussion of the difference between an expression and a communication.
You've been listening to Icon Art Radio, a production of Iowa Contemporary Art, Fairfield.